Good morning. Time now for an early morning roundup of the day's news from the war fronts of the world. In just a moment, we're going to hear from our on-the-scenes reporter in the Far East, in London, and from our own nation's capital in Washington, D.C. First this morning, we are going to switch to the Netherlands East Indies for a report from Sidney Albright. Go ahead, Batavia, Java.
This is Sidney Albright, speaking in Batavia. The time is 9:30 on Sunday evening. Today's operation of the Japanese Air Force in Netherlands East Indies territory extended over an area roughly the distance between New York and London. Montauk on the island of Bunker was raided, as was an unnamed city in New Guinea. A study of the map will clearly show the strategic importance of these two places as guardians of the approaches to Java. Bunker and Bilitan Island are the obstacles located at the foot of the South China Sea and the opening to the Java Sea, forming a natural line of resistance against any attempted southward advance from Hainan Island, French Indochina, Thailand, or North Borneo. The importance of New Guinea decreases with every new Japanese occupation in the Celebes area, a part of which is already in enemy hands. On the surface, the most prominent single action today was the raid on Surabaya, where 35 persons were killed and 50 were wounded in an attempt to destroy the dock. Damage was also inflicted on the Navy base, but of relatively slight importance. An undisclosed number of Japanese planes carried out reconnaissance over Batavia yesterday, the first enemy appearance over the capital city so far reported. In the district of Pangalengan, near Bandung, a group of tea pickers working in the field were machine gunned by a low-flying plane. However, there were no casualties. Salambang in Sumatra was again attacked, this time by 6 bombers with a strong escort of fighters. Some Dutch planes were destroyed on the ground when they caught fire as a result of the bombardment. In the attack on New Guinea, only 2 persons were wounded, one seriously and one slightly. At Montauk, 10 civilians were killed, 6 seriously wounded, and 30 slightly wounded. The communique says many fires were started at Montauk, while damage was not insignificant. The communique also tells of enemy reconnaissance over East Java and over North Sumatra. Although the general situation in the Indies is more serious than ever before, as emphasized in the latest communiques, yesterday's announcement of the sinking of one Japanese cruiser and one large transport ship and the damaging of a cruiser and a submarine brought great satisfaction to observers here. It is fully realized that although the Indies' vital need at the moment is mainly air power in order to stem the Japanese advance, it's the Japanese sea power that is responsible for most of the previous successes. Therefore, it is considered most important that the Japanese must realize the danger of their gradually increasing losses. The Dutch East Indies have been at war for 63 days, during which time 56 enemy ships have been put out of action. This includes warships of all types, numerous large transport ships, also some tankers carrying precious aviation gasoline, which is irreplaceable. On the other hand, the Dutch naval commander-in-chief stated yesterday, quote, "The Netherlands Indies fleet is intact, at sea, and ready for action," unquote. The CNC emphasized that since the war started, Dutch naval losses have been almost negligible. Naval observers here stress that while the Japanese are losing valuable units of their battle fleet in daring exploits in the narrow channels of the Indies, the future major engagement with the United States fleet, which Tokyo knows is inescapable, looms as a threatening shadow over the heads of the Japanese admirals, who know they'll need many, many months to replace the heavy losses already suffered. An unpleasant prospect for the warlords in the land of the rising sun. I now return you to San Francisco.
Next to the newsroom in New York.
And here are some late bulletins. Moscow.
The Russians are telling of a party of 93 Soviet border guards which operated for 3 months behind the German lines. The guards now have reached Russian-held territory again, and they say they killed more than 1,400 German officers and men during their jaunt. They also mined roads, blew up enemy supply columns, and destroyed 10 bridges. And according to the government newspaper, Izvestia, they wrecked 15 miles of railway track, as well as giving many signals to Soviet aircraft, allowing them to bomb German troops and cars. Several times, the guerrilla band attacked villages where Germans were quartered. Once, they killed or wounded 180 out of 200 Finnish troops sleeping in a schoolhouse. And now, once again, we take you overseas. We switch you now to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. London heard from Singapore today that the Japanese have stepped up their air and artillery bombardment of the island. The scale of the air raids and the shelling is said to have been considerably increased. The British guns fired across the strait at enemy working parties and broke them up. Enemy forces moving toward the east of the mainland also came under British shell fire. The Japanese have made a landing on the island of Pulau Ubin, between the east end of Singapore Island and the mainland. Authoritative quarters in London don't seem worried by the new Japanese move. They say the landing doesn't bring the Japanese any closer to their main objective. The only news London has from Libya so far today is that British mobile columns and air patrols have been operating over a wide area west and southwest of the British front about Gazala. It's stated that no important enemy bodies were engaged. The story of the pikes issued to Home Guards has caused a lot of caustic comment in Britain. Most of the Sunday papers take a crack at the idea, and there are references to running the war with antiquated strategy and balaclava brains. Talking of British Home Guard equipment recalls the story of the Home Guard invasion maneuvers. The men had no equipment, but they were told to say bang to represent a rifle, bang bang to represent a machine gun, and whoosh to mean the thrust of a bayonet. In the course of the maneuvers, one Home Guard met another and said bang. The man kept coming, so the first Home Guard said bang bang. The man kept coming. Finally, the Home Guard said whoosh. The man kept coming, and the Home Guard shouted, "What do you mean by not stopping when I've killed you three times with a rifle, a machine gun, and a bayonet?" Then the second man spoke for the first time. "Chug, chug," he said, "I'm a tank." This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
For a word on events at home, here is Morgan Beatty speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
The Navy Department announces that the Sogoni vacuum tanker, China Arrow, has been torpedoed off the Atlantic coast. But all the crew, 37 survivors, have been landed at Lewes, Delaware. The sinking of the China Arrow brings to 20 the number of ships sunk in Atlantic coast water. This news, plus the reports you have heard from Batavia, London, and New York, add up to this fact. The armed forces of the Allied nations are bracing today to receive new Axis blows, certainly in the Far East and in the Atlantic and possibly in the Mediterranean. To that end, the Allied High Command has been established in Washington. It is setting up a strategic board for military and supply problems and forming new commands in the Pacific to backstop the defenders of Singapore, the Philippines, and the Indies. The naming of Vice Admiral Leary of the United States Fleet as commander of the United Nations forces in Australia and New Zealand waters is a part of our changing strategy, a plan that apparently embraces Australia as the great Allied base in the far Pacific war zone. The selection of Admiral Leary is also special recognition of the demands of the Dutch and the Australians that an American admiral should command Pacific forces. On the domestic front, neither Congress nor parts of the executive branch of the government are quite so well braced to face possible setbacks in the war theaters. Congress, for example, has just emerged from a storm of criticism by constituents who don't like the idea of congressmen voting themselves the right to a federal pension. And congressmen proved they not only could take criticism, but they could, in the vernacular, dish it out too. They are objecting loudly to putting actor and dancer friends of Mrs. Roosevelt on the federal payroll with civilian defense. And there are new and sinister clouds on the labor horizon again, too. In New York State, plans are afoot to form a dairy farmers union as a subsidiary to John L. Lewis's mine workers. And in Detroit, CIO leader Walter P. Rother, director of the United Auto Workers Union, declares that war production programs cannot be a total success until labor is given a strong voice in organization. These demands follow within less than a week the frank admission by a shipbuilder's agent that his company has made unconscionable profits out of war work. And they also follow within 2 weeks after the farm bloc had enforced its demands for a 110% ceiling on farm prices and had given the Secretary of Agriculture a veto power over Price Control Administrator Leon Henderson. Taken together, all of this is plain evidence that group interests in the United States have not been completely subordinated as yet to the national interest. Labor, industry, the farmer, and all other large groups apparently are still absorbed in their own rival positions. They are thoroughly patriotic, of course, but they can't take their eye off the other fellow for fear he'll steal a march on them. All these groups would do well to read the letter placed in the Congressional Record yesterday by a congressman from Louisiana. The congressman called it an American soldier's letter. It was written the day after the war began by a man called Salvatore Anselmo, an American of Italian descent, and he says in part, "I want you at home to realize that I'm proud I have the opportunity to offer my services for the defense of what I and all of us believe in. I feel privileged to fight for Dad's right to vote, for Mom's right to her religion, for Vincent's right to denounce one party or uphold another in public, for Rose's right to speak her mind and to act according to her principles, within the law, of course, for Angie's and Nancy's right to marry whom they please and when they please. But, dearest people I love, don't be alarmed or hysterical. You, too, must be loyal and patriotic. No sacrifice, no matter what it may be, is too much to give in order to preserve your rights. Those are Salvador's convictions. Tomorrow the nation goes on wartime. The clocks will be put on, as the British say, or turned up, as we say it, 1 hour at 2 a.m. The plan conserves daylight and probably will save 1.5 billion kilowatt hours of electricity annually. That's all for now."
And that's the report up to this moment. These have been reports by Sidney Albright in Batavia, John McVane in London, and Morgan Beatty in Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.